2 Kings chapter 3 is where we left off last time. So we continue on these Sunday evenings to look at the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and we find ourselves now in 2 Kings beginning in chapter 3. Verse 1. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel at Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned 12 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and mother, Ahab and Jezebel, for he put away the sacred pillar of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he persisted in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin, and he did not depart from them. The standard for our lives is the Word of God. The standard is not our parents. It's not what somebody else is or isn't doing in obedience to the Lord. The standard isn't 50% or 80% or even 90%. The standard is what God declares in His Word. And here is a man who has done partly what he was supposed to do, but he didn't go all of the way. And the lesson of this man for us here in this beginning section of chapter 3 is that what God wanted from this man was not partial obedience. He wanted full obedience, and he wanted repentance from him. And maybe some of us here tonight, that we have allowed the standard that we saw, the lives of our parents, lives of a significant person in our life, or even the standard of someone who calls themselves a Christian and is a Christian, to become the standard in our life. It's not the standard. The standard is the Word of God, and he fell short of it, and God took note of it. Now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep herder, and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. And so he's a vassal king. Moab has been under the dominion of the northern kingdom of Israel, and this was kind of the tribute that he would bring every year. It was significant. But now with Ahab dead, all of these vassal kings are going to test the power of these sons that are now taking the place of the king. And so it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab, verse 5, rebelled against the king of Israel. And so King Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time and he mustered all of Israel. He leaves the capital city of Samaria and he gathers all of Israel together to fight against Moab. And then he went and he said to Jehoshaphat, the king of the southern kingdom of Judah, saying, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab?" And Jehoshaphat said, "I will go up. I am as you are. My people as your people. My horses as your horses." This is a characteristic of Jehoshaphat. We saw him do the same thing with Ahab in earlier chapters. He's a great man. He's a wonderful king. He's a tremendous reformer. And caused the Word of God to be spoken forth through the land. Did some great things as it relates to the southern kingdom of Judah. And really one of those guys that you just like. You read him and he's a likable guy. And yet he seems to have this characteristic. Now I don't know where that phrase, "jumping Jehoshaphat," came from. I don't know what its origin. It's a dangerous thing to say something. You don't know what the origin of it is. Somebody will and they'll be offended. But It may be biblical, because every time we see Jehoshaphat, this guy is jumping into a situation that he should not be jumping into. And we see no prayer on his part. And again, as with Ahab, he's aligning himself with an evil man. He's aligning himself with an ungodly man. And as a leader, he is thus aligning a nation and a people unnecessarily and putting them in danger just because he kind of jumps into this thing. Jehoshaphat and the southern kingdom of Judah were nothing like Jehoram and nothing like the northern kingdom of Israel at this point. They were two entirely different, and yet this is offered to him, and he jumps into it. He goes after it. And there's no trace of prayer. Again, the very thing that happened to him with Ahab, where he got out by the skin of his teeth, as the old saying goes, almost killed in that battle, and yet he hasn't learned his lesson. He commits himself to fighting with Jehoram. It's interesting to me that King Jehoram approaches Jehoshaphat. And Jehorams are always going to approach Jehoshaphats. And you're going to be approached by Jehorams. It's going to be the way that it is. If you're walking with the Lord and the Lord is using you, there's an attraction to your life. There's a supernaturalness about your life. And even if the person that's walking in disobedience to the Lord doesn't understand the fullness of the presence of God in your life, at the very least, they consider you lucky just to have you along. I mean, you never know. I mean, you can't do any harm to have them along. And we have to be careful to pray about, you know, what we get involved in. And he doesn't. He jumps right into the middle of it. And then Jehoshaphat asked, which way shall we go up? And he answered, by way of the wilderness of Edom. So now he's taking directions from this king, and they're going to go by the way of the wilderness of Edom. Edom, a very desolate section of southern Israel, in order to come around and surprise the Moabites, which were a group of people located in a fairly desolate section of the Middle East themselves. And so the king of Israel went with the king of Judah and the king of Edom. They're all joined together, and they marched on that roundabout route 7 days, and there was no water for the army nor for the animals that followed them. Now, one of the things you have to know about joining up with a Jehoram is that they're not good detail people. And so here they are now out in the middle of nowhere, and now there's no water. And 7 days without water in that area is pretty rough. And the king of Israel said, alas, for the Lord has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. And so here is Jehoram, and he pipes up here, and now he knows how to use the name of the Lord. You know, here it is, for the Lord has called these three kings together. No, he didn't. He didn't call them together at all. The Lord has nothing to do with this. He hasn't been asked about this. He's no involvement at all. And so, but he takes the blame. He takes the blame for a lot of things that he's not involved in at all. And here's, you know, here is Jehoram's evil conscience. We've all been, you know, delivered into the hand of Moab. But Jehoshaphat said, is there no prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of the Lord by him? Now, one thing about Jehoshaphat, again, he is not, you could never accuse him of not seeking the Lord. It's just that he always sought the Lord after he made his decision, which is going to get us in a lot of hot water. So you could never say, this is a guy that just never sought the Lord. No, he always sought the Lord when everything began to blow up. And I know that's foreign to all of us. We don't understand anything. I have great compassion for Jehoshaphat. Got a little jumper in me for that. And that's, you know, one of the ways that we learn. Well, better late than never. And so he says, is there a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of the Lord by him? And one of the servants of the king of Israel answered and said, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah. They said, oh, Elijah's in the area. And you know what I love about this is that Elijah, when they think of Elisha, they say, Elisha is here. When they speak of Elisha, they don't say, oh, Elisha, that great miracle worker. What comes to mind is it was the servant of Elijah, the man that poured water on the hands of Elijah. For all the great ways that the Lord was using Elisha, he was still known for that great characteristic of being a servant. That's what he was, and that's how the people saw him. You know, God help us that we don't become, any of us in our service to the Lord, known for something that we think is higher than being a servant of the Lord, one who's willing, you know, to pour water over the hands of those that the Lord is using, any way to be used of the Lord. And Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. And so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. And then Elisha said to the king of Israel, this guy, now he's just like Elijah. I mean, different in personality, but the same spirit is on him. And he's going to rebuke now the king of Israel. And it's beautiful because as you read this, you realize that here is the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. He's got all of the power. He's got all of the titles. He's got all of the accolades. He's got everything that people dream of having. And yet, when he comes face to face with a man, when he comes face to face with a godly man, there's a huge gulf between the two of them. They're two entirely different kinds of men. And Elisha says to the king of Israel, what do I have to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and the prophets of your mother. And the king of Israel said to him, no, for the Lord has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. He's going to stand with this thing. God doesn't have anything to do with this. And he's trying to sell this thing on Elisha that this is what God has done. God hasn't done anything at all, but Elisha says, listen, where is your God now? Where is he now? You know, I think that all of us sooner or later, we hit that place in our life where sooner or later we're going to hear, you know, where is your God now? Where is your God now? Well, the things that we built our lives upon, the things that we trusted in, things that we gave our youth to and our health to and our money to and all of these things. And then, you know, then we hit the impossible situation. And sometimes, so often, the Lord will send a prophet and say, where is your God now? The things that you worship. Now, when the Lord sends a prophet like that and we're broken and we're ready to turn to the true and the living God, it's a little different than this scene here. You get a sense of love in the situation. Well, where are your gods now? Well, I spent them. They're all up my nose. They died this weekend. And then you realize, boy, those were pretty lousy gods, weren't they? And then the Lord begins to reveal himself to us. And what is necessary in a God if you want to, you know, what is the minimum thing needed or required in a God before you call it the God of your life? This man is different because this is the kind of man that's just looking to God to get him out of a tough spot right now, and he has no intention of turning to God or changing his ways. And Elisha knows it and the Lord knows it, and so the strong rebuke. And then Elisha said in verse 14, as the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I would not look at you nor see you. Now Jehoshaphat's heart had to begin to flutter a little bit here, kind of excited. Whew! And yet for the king of Israel, his has to be sinking. And then Elisha says, but now bring me a musician. And it happened when the musician played, that the hand of the Lord came upon him. And he said, thus says the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. That's kind of a weird thing, isn't it? They need water, and God's going to provide water, but they've put themselves in a bit of a pickle, and so God isn't just going to provide water. He's going to have them dig ditches in what is a pretty rough area to dig ditches in, and then he's going to provide the water for them. You know, so he'll bail us out, but he'll teach us some things while he's bailing us out, you know. I think you just got to dig a few ditches before you'll think the next time, you know, about jumping into something. And so when the Lord says to make this valley full of ditches, then that's what you do. If God said it, then you do it. He's got something in mind, even though it seems like a strange command at times. For thus says the Lord, you shall not see wind, nor shall you see rain, yet that valley shall be filled with water so that you, your cattle, and your animals may drink. And this is but a trivial thing in the sight of the Lord. You came to me, thought you were asking some kind of a big thing of God, you know, that he'd provide water for you. Listen, now you're dealing with someone that's worthy of being called God. You need to provide a little water. He will also deliver the Moabites into your hand. And also you shall attack every fortified city and every choice city, and shall cut down every good tree, that is a fruit tree, that's a reference to the fruit trees, and stop up every spring of water, and ruin every good piece of land with stones. Now it happened in the morning when the grain offering was offered, that suddenly water came by way of Edom, and the land was filled with water. And when all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to bear arms and older were gathered, and they stood at the border. And then they arose early in the morning, and the sun was shining on the water, and the Moabites saw the water on the other side, and it looked as red as blood. And they said, "This is blood. The kings have surely struck swords and killed one another. Now therefore, Moab to the spoil." And so when they came to the camp of Israel, Israel rose and attacked the Moabites, so that they fled before them, and they entered their land, killing the Moabites, and they destroyed the cities, and each man threw a stone on every good piece of land and filled it, and they stopped up the springs of water, cut down all of the good trees, except that they left intact the stones of Kir Harosheth. However, the slingers surrounded and attacked it. And when the king of Moab saw that the battle was too intense for him, he took with him 700 men who drew swords to try and break through to the king of Edom, but he could not. And then he took his eldest son, who would have reigned in his place, and he offered him as a burnt offering on the wall, and there was great indignation against Israel. And so they departed from the land, from him, and returned to their own land. Here this king takes. And he takes his son, and he puts down the wood on the wall of the city so that all of the attacking armies can see. And he burns him as a burnt offering, as an offering, no doubt, to his false god there, in order for his false god to try and deliver him out of this situation. And when the king of Israel and the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, look and they see this, even the king of Edom, it says there was great indignation against Israel. In other words, they turned to Jehoram and they were angry. In other words, what did you get us into? Look at how this has ended. It was a stench in their nostrils. And so they left the scene. And so often that's the case. Once something is played out in its fullness, you know, the Lord will get ourselves into something, and he'll bail us out in his grace. But very often something will happen that will leave a stench in our nostrils, so that we'll be careful the next time before we get involved in battles with ungodly people. Chapter 4. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead." So apparently kind of a disciple, one of the prophets. They had kind of a school of the prophets in those days. And so he apparently associated with Elisha, servant, was dead. "And you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves." So apparently he was a prophet, but he was a prophet in debt. The Bible says that the borrower is a servant to the lender, and now he dies. You know, he presumes upon the future that he's going to be able to pay off the debt. He dies before he's able to. And now his sons are in danger of being sold in order to pay off the debt. And so the widow woman comes now to Elisha. That's a good place to go. And so Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me. What do you have in the house?" He's going to use something that she has in order to meet this need. And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil." That's a slimly furnished house. All that's in there is just a jar of oil. And so he said, "Go borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels, and don't gather just a few. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons, and pour it into all those vessels, and set aside the full ones." And so she went from him, shut the door behind her and her sons, and who brought the vessels to her, and she poured out now this jar of oil. And it came to pass that she's pouring forth, and she pours until all of the vessels are full, until she says to her son, "Bring me another vessel. We're on a streak." And he said to her, "There's not another vessel." And so the oil ceased. And then she came and told the man of God what had happened. And he said to her, "Go and sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. Now, I've heard interesting things done with this particular passage and all, but at the very least, what we see here, and continually in the ministry of Elisha, is that God used him to perform, you wouldn't say, normal kind of miracles, but he did a lot of miracles that just met an immediate need of a family or of a person. That's what it was. It wasn't 75, ways to spiritualize it or 175 lessons out of it. There was a need in this woman's life, and she went to him as a representative of the Lord, and the Lord, through Elisha, met this woman's need. Sometimes the Lord just wants to use miracles and to use his people to perform miracles just to meet a particular need. He's not going to bring, peace to the Middle East through us on it, or he's not going to, change an entire continent maybe through it. He just wants to do a miracle through our lives in a particular situation. There is no man in the Old Testament that God used more for miracles other than Moses than Elisha. And so many of them were just this kind of miracle. And what the Lord was doing was before his people now, in the northern kingdom of Israel, in such apostasy, it's so far from the Lord now, and yet the Lord is maintaining a constant witness of himself through Elisha and through these miracles and the meeting of the need of the people. I tell you, we need to, in the depravity of the day in which we live, we need to be more than open to the Lord using us to do whatever he wants, including the miraculous. We need to live in the expectation of that happening so that there's that witness of the Lord in our life. One of the characteristics of the early church was they were more than just open to spiritual gifts and to be used by God. They were exhorted, desire earnestly the best gifts. And there was a desiring earnestly of those gifts. You read the book of Acts, and they seem to wake up with an anticipation over what God might do that day. It doesn't mean that you fabricate things or, get some kind of a program going and, you do these three things and then God has to come in behind with a miracle. But there's that anticipation that the Lord might do anything at any given moment in time, and he may do it, and he may even be as concerned with my neighbor who is going to have to sell her sons to pay off a debt as to solve some kind of a world crisis. It's beautiful. The Lord loves to be involved in everything and loves to leave his fingerprints over what we deem to be the small things in life. And yet it's a powerful witness to him. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she constrained him to eat some food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, that he turned in there to eat some food. So here's a woman, what a gift of hospitality. There weren't just head down the highway, in your car, and, which one of these restaurants should we stop at? Wasn't that kind of a deal, when you're going from one place to another, got some jerky maybe, it's some old bread or whatever, so to have someone invite you in and have something fresh, that was terrific. And here she is, she invites him in to eat. Every time he goes by, he could come in. Nobody was getting tired of him. It was terrific. A gift of hospitality. Nobody rolling their eyes. Oh, here comes the prophet again. And wouldn't you know it, it's dinner time. Nope, they have the gift of hospitality. And she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly." Nice to be known as that, wouldn't it? Ah, here comes here comes that holy man of God. "Please let us make a small upper room on the wall and let us put a bed for him there, a table and a chair and a lampstand. And so it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there." And so they provide him with a room. That's nice. And look at what this room, this is a very nicely furnished room. Let's see, we've got a bed in there, and there's a table, and a chair, and a lampstand. You can minister with just a bed, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand? Uh-huh. You can. We'd be amazed at what we can get by without, and probably do more without. So, very, very simple, simple room. And it happened one day that she came there, and he turned into the upper room and lay down there. And then he said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite woman. And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, say now to her, look, you've been concerned for us with all of this care, and we are thankful. What can we do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king? That king? No, thank you. Or to the commander of the army? And she answered, beautiful answer, I dwell among my own people. Listen, I'm glad to help you, and I am absolutely content. I don't want you to do anything for me. Well, that would ruin the American economy. I mean, it's just beautiful here. How many are running into that kind of contentment? And so he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son, and her husband is old. So she doesn't have a son, and the prospects aren't good. And in that day, not to have a child, not to have a son, was considered a reproach of God. And so he said, call her. And when Gehazi had called her, she stood in the doorway. And then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. And so, obviously, he had struck a nerve. This was a desire of her heart. And he had promised, don't you be lying to me. And the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elisha had told her. And so the child grew. So some number of years have go by here, and until he's old enough now to work in the fields. And it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers, and then he said to his father, my head, my head. So somehow, maybe not like that. The bells. These old movies, they just flash at the worst time in your mind, you know. The plane. And so he said to his father, let's get this right. I don't want you leaving with ideas concerning me. He said to his father, my head, you know, and, you know, kids are... You never know sometimes whether they... Come on, get it. Here, come back. And, you know, you never know how serious anything is, but this one is serious. Maybe he's got some sunstroke, they figure. And also, the father says to the servant, carry him to his mother. And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees until noon, and then he dies. Dies on his mother's knees. Ooh. You can imagine what went on inside of the Shunammite woman. And she went up and she laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, and went out. And then she called to her husband and said, please send one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back. And the husband said, doesn't know anything about the death of his son. Why are you going to him today? It's neither a new moon nor the Sabbath. It's not a holy day to, you know, go after the holy man. And she said to him, it is well. You know, so here's a mother, wife. No time to explain, it's well. And so she saddles a donkey, said to the servant, drive and go forward. And do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you. In other words, kick this donkey in gear and let's get out of here and get to the man of God. And so she departed and she went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. And so the difference in distance between Shunem and Mount Carmel was about 15 miles. And so, you know, she's probably not a young woman and she is moving. And all is an expression of her faith in God. And she is confident in God's grace. And so she's going now to find this, the prophet of the Lord. And so it was, when the man of God saw her afar off, that he said to his servant Gehazi, "Look, there is the Shunammite woman. Please run now to meet her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?'" Good, three good questions to ask, isn't it? Important questions. And she answered to Gehazi, "It is well." I don't want to deal with Gehazi. I'm not dealing with a servant. I want to deal with the big guy. And so she's heading to see, you know, Elisha. "Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came near to push her away. But the man of God said, 'Let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me.'" Isn't that interesting? Here is Elisha. And Elisha is marveling over the fact that God has done something and didn't inform him of it. The fact of the matter is, concerning you and I, I'm thrilled when I hear him. I can keep a journal on the times that I've heard him, the way that Elisha. And here he was so used to hearing the Lord, so clear was that communication, and just part of the relationship and the call on Elisha's life, that he's surprised when God didn't reveal to him that there was a distress here. So, you know, really a beautiful, beautiful use of the prophet by the Lord. And she said, "Did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Don't deceive me'? Did I ask for a son of you? Did I bring up the subject of a son? Did I, you know, ask for this to happen, and now I've been given a son, and now he's dead? Did I need this trial? Did I need this situation in my life? And you've given me a son. Didn't I say, 'Don't deceive me'? And then he said to Gehazi, 'Get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. And if you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child.'" I want you to take this staff. I want you to head right to that house, and I want you to lay this staff on the face of the child, and I don't want anyone to interrupt you. And the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." And so he arose and he followed her. Now Gehazi went on ahead of them, and he laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet him and told him, saying to Elisha, "The child has not awakened." And so Elisha, surely when he sent Gehazi with that staff, to lay that staff upon the boy, he anticipated that the boy would be raised from the dead by the Lord. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen. He thought it would happen, but it didn't happen. And I have no doubt that he is surprised at the ineffectiveness of what has just happened. But the problem is that a staff in the hand of an Elisha is going to be entirely different from that same staff in the hand of a Gehazi. Because a Gehazi doesn't have the integrity of his master, as we're going to see in a couple of chapters here. And so Gehazi, he's half-hearted towards the Lord. He's involved in the love of money, has a sin of covetousness in his life. And so what that staff would have done in the hand of an Elisha, it will not do in the hand of a hypocrite. There will not be any power. And a person should never think that it's the fault of the staff or the fault of the Word of God, but rather, search out my own life for what sin causes this thing to be ineffective. It causes me to go through the motions, and yet there is no power there. And this should have been a warning sign to Gehazi, but it isn't. He's not going to change until God is forced to deal with him in a very strong way. One of the things that's also fascinating to me is the fact that Elisha was for so long blind to the sin in the heart of his servant. Here was this guy, he knew so much. God revealed so much to him, and yet he never saw, we have no indication that he did, never saw the condition of his servant's heart there. I remember when we had just moved here into the community, and I remember that there was a situation that had happened in a church here in town, and a man had left that church as a result of it, and then he had come to this church. And he explained the situation to me, and then he said to me, he said, I could never listen to a pastor that could, something like that could happen to in his church without, you know, him knowing it. If a man can't hear from God better than that, then I'm not going to sit and listen to him. And it was one of those situations where, you know, it would have been nice if somebody had known, but it was one of those things where a Gehazi had gone undetected for a long time. There was no evidence that a Gehazi was a Gehazi and not wholehearted towards the things of the Lord, and everyone got surprised. And I remember when this guy told me that, because now he was going to this church. I give him 2 weeks. Listen, you can fool an Elisha. God can even keep an Elisha blind. Men and women can be fooled. We're not God. And we don't have sometimes his level of discernment. And sometimes the Lord can just keep us blind, not when it puts someone in danger, because he knows what he's going to do here necessarily. But sometimes he can just keep us blind. And sometimes in the ministry, when something comes down and you look at it and you just think, why didn't I know? I mean, if I was any kind of a leader, if I was any kind of a pastor, if I was any kind of a husband, any kind of a leader of this house, then surely I would have seen that. Hey, Elisha didn't see it. Didn't see it. I don't know, you know, all the ins and outs of these kinds of things. I just know that it happens. And sometimes the Lord just deals real quietly between him and a Gehazi as he's trying to get a Gehazi's heart turned around, and he even keeps it from an Elisha. And so here is a situation where a prophet, enormously gifted, enormously sensitive to the Lord, and yet he is unaware of what's going on inside of this man's heart. I'll tell you, this passage is really a warning to me of how interesting it is that a man like Gehazi can be so close to a man as spiritual as Elisha is and still be backslidden in heart. And that happens too. Just look and say, how in the world could he do that? Oh, the heart is deceitful. Above all things, it's desperately wicked. It's amazing. And yet here he is. He's in this position, tremendous position, and yet he stays with that sin in his heart. And so in verse 32, when Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. And he went in, therefore, and he shut the door behind the two of them, and he prayed to the Lord. I mean, what's Elisha going to do? He says, Lord, what do you want to do here? Lord, what's going on here? And he went up, and he lay on the child, and he put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. And so here now, God honors this ministry of Elisha in bringing forth this son back from the dead. And sometimes in our service to the Lord, there are things that God is going to use us to do, and you can send a million people ahead of you to try and take care of it, and it's not going to move until I'm the one that gets involved in that situation. There are situations that are like that. As someone said, you know, you can send your staff all you want, but there's some things that, you know, you have to do yourself. And that's the case sometimes. Not all things, praise the Lord. And so he returned and he walked back and forth in the house, and again he went up and he stretched himself out on him, and then the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes, and then he called Gehazi and said, call this Shunammite woman. And so he called her, and when she came to him, he said, pick up your son. And so she went in and she fell at his feet and bowed to the ground, and then she picked up her son and she went out, and God rewarded her for her faith. And Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. Now the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, and he said to his servant, "Put on a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets." So, you know, food is a little bit scarce. There's a famine in the land. You got to feed a lot of people. Apparently there's, you know, Elisha, his life is involved in ministry to a larger group of younger men who are, you know, involved in this ministry as a prophet. And so let's make some stew. And so one went out into the field to gather herbs, and he found a wild vine, and he gathered from it a lap full of wild gourds. Now listen, when there's a famine and the whole land has been stripped of everything edible, and there's a vine that has a bunch of gourds on it, you kind of have to know that nobody's touching those for a reason, probably because they're poisonous. And so it's a little fun fact for you tonight, that not to just pick anything and say, "Ooh, there's a whole bunch of this, we'll slice them and put them in the stew," which is what they did, though they did not know what they were. So it's a mystery stew that they're putting together here. And then they served it to the men to eat. All men won't care. You serve them anything. Just get it. Now it happened as they were eating the stew that they cried out and they said, "Oh man of God, there's death in the pot." "Well," said the cook. Be careful quoting this verse at someone's house. And they could not eat it. And so he said, "Then bring me some flour." And so he put it into the pot and said, "Serve it to the people that they may eat." And there's that other-centeredness of Elisha. We see this over and over again. He is so much a picture and a type of Jesus. Elijah is so much a picture of John the Baptist. And here he see, serve it to the people, the concern for the people. We're going to see it again in just a few verses. And there was nothing harmful in the pot. And then a man came from Baal, that place, and he brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley bread, and newly ripened grain in his knapsack. And he said, "Give it to the people that they may eat." Elisha did. And his servant said, "What? Shall I set this before 100 men? These guys are hungry. They're going to wipe it out in a second." And then Elisha said to him again, "Give it to the people that they may eat." Again, that "give it to the people." "For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over." And so he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. And so we see a picture that looks very much like what Jesus is later going to do with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Chapter 5. Now Naaman, commander, is the commander of the army of the king of Syria, and he was a great and an honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. And so here is the Lord working not only through the nation of Israel, but here is the Lord working involved in Gentile history also. And so here's a man, he's a commander of the army, he's great, he's honorable in the eyes of his master, he's a mighty man of valor, and then that end of verse 1, "But he was a leper." That's a kind of a guy. It's all of that verse 1 describes what we would call as a self-made man. You know, there's some people in life that no matter what they touch, they're able to make something out of it. And they're the toughest people sometimes to reach for the Lord. The hardest ones. And I'll tell you, you know, that self-made man, they can build anything, they can do anything, point them in that direction, and they'll turn a corporation around, or, I mean, whatever it is. And so there's the virtues, all of these great virtues as it relates to his life. But concerning his life, there's that important word there, that word "but." For all of the things that this man is, all of the things that this man was, he was still a leper. He was still a leper. The interesting thing in the scriptures is that leprosy is very, very often used as a type of sin. That's why in the New Testament, when leprosy is being addressed by the Lord, it's never spoken of as being healed. You never hear in the New Testament where leprosy was healed as it relates to a person. It was always cleansed. There was always the cleansing of the leper, because leprosy is a type of sin from the Old Testament. Interesting thing about leprosy is it was a fatal disease to get. There was no cure. There was no way that a man could cure himself of leprosy. There's no way that a man can in and of himself cure him of sin. One of the things that was it always culminated in a life of isolation. In other words, you were forced to live around other lepers. It resulted in a life of isolation. Funny thing about sin is that if I'm not going to accept God's cleansing for my sin, as life goes on, isn't it interesting how we find ourselves congregating around the people that are afflicted by our particular sin, afflicted by that leprosy? Another thing that's interesting about leprosy, even to this day, even though it's called Hansen's disease today, is that they're still absolutely puzzled as to its means of transmission. They can take someone and put him in a room with a bunch of lepers, and he won't get leprosy. Doesn't get it. They can take and inject body fluids from a leper into one individual, and he won't get any leprosy. Someone else has chance contact with a leper, and he'll pick up leprosy. There's no way that they've defined and said, this is the way that you get leprosy. This is how it's transmitted from one person to the other. Isn't it interesting? You don't really know how it's transmitted from parent to child, really. We just know that when those children come out, they are born lepers. They're born sinners. What was the means of transmission? You know, well, their physical body. And so there's that transmission of sin. Everyone is born a sinner. And so here's this man, for all of the greatness of his life, there's that word but he was a leper. And for all of the greatness of any person's life, you may be a self-made man here tonight, you may be a self-made woman, but I guarantee you there's a but associated with your life. All of these things, you get garner all of these accolades and the praise from this king and from this boss and from this and this and this and this. But there's something in your life that's beyond your control to change. You can't do it. You're helpless before it. And it's that thing that the Lord uses to humble us and to bring us into contact with Him. And so a great, great man. And the Syrians had gone out, verse 2, on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. Now, all you have to do is have an incurable disease to understand what those words would do to you. That communication is going to go through the palace faster than any communication go through the palace. And so now here is Naaman, and this is declared to his wife concerning the fact that there's someone that can heal him of his leprosy. And so Naaman went in. He hears about this. He goes into his master, the king, and says, thus and thus said the girl who was from the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, go now, and I will send the letter to the king of Israel. And so he departed, and he took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And someone has said that the dollar amount, U.S. dollar amount, for that today is in the gold and silver is about $2.5 million. This guy's ready to pay big bucks to get healed of his leprosy, cleansed of his leprosy. He must have known, you know, what the medical profession was going to become in terms of expenses. You leave me alone and don't write me any letters about that. You know you're well paid. And we love you. We want the best. You're not? We want the, I'll tell you, I'm gonna, if I've got 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold? I'm going to get the best too, so I'm not faulting him at all. Are you getting out of this? Okay. And then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, "Now be advised that this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy." So here is, you know, Jehoram, he receives this letter now that he's supposed to heal this man of his leprosy. This guy can't even get out of the desert on a horse with no name and get water and attack the Moabites, and now he's being asked to heal a guy of his leprosy. And it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." This guy's wanting to fight with me. He's wanting a war with me. Heal him of his leprosy. And so it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes. This guy's, his day's wrecked. He's in mourning. That he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me and he shall know that there's a prophet in Israel." Why did you tear your clothes? He just came to the wrong man.
Ooh. And he did.
And what God is showing this king in an attempt to wake him up to the fact that he's no longer the big guy in the nation. God is bypassing this man to accomplish his purposes. And then Naaman went and he, with his horses and his chariot, and he stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And then Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean." And so Elisha doesn't even come out of his little house to greet Naaman. Doesn't even come out and address him personally. He sends a servant. He sends his messenger out to speak to this man. In other words, what is he doing with Naaman? He's treating Naaman like a leper. And Naamans don't like to be treated like lepers, even though they are lepers. Elisha is treating Naaman in a way that makes him realize how serious his affliction is, and that for him to come out and address this man and deal with him had the potential of making him unclean. And Naaman is furious that he is being treated like a leper. And how furious Naamans become today when they are actually treated like a sinner. The self-made man, the self-made person, the person that could turn anything around and all as it relates to their area of weakness, as it relates to their sin, they hate it to be treated just like everyone else. And yet with Elisha, we see in his dealings with all of the other people, he's very, very gentle. And yet here, he's almost foreign to us. It's like, where's Elisha? Where did Elisha go that he's dealing with people this way? And yet, there's a reason for it. Because he knows the kind of a man he's dealing with. God knows the kind of a man that he's dealing with. And this man's condition can't be minimized. And so he's very, very direct. He's almost curt in his dealing with him. He's not going to minimize this man's condition. And when a person does that, with a Naaman concerning their sin, you are going to make Naaman's very, very, very upset. And he's upset in his pride in verse 11, and he becomes furious, and he went away and said, "Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me. This is what I had planned. And he'll stand and he'll call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place, and heal the leprosy." That's what I would have done. That's what he should have done. And here he is. He's all upset in his pride because he doesn't like how someone like him is being treated like a common person, just like everyone else, just like a sinner. And the Naaman is always more concerned about his dignity And thankfully, Elisha remained supremely concerned about Naaman's disease. And so he doesn't stand in awe of this man, the greatness of this man's need. And Naaman is upset because he doesn't like the way God is going to heal him of his leprosy. He would have done it entirely different. And he's upset because it doesn't make any sense to him. This would have made sense. Bring the prophet out. Let's have a big show of it. Wave around a little bit and dvizzled, vazzled, vazzled, vom, a little bit of this in the place, and then heal the leprosy and then take care of it. And that would have been the way that he would have done it. But it didn't happen that way. And so he's furious over the whole situation. And he said, are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all of the rivers of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? And so he turned and he went away in a rage. And this to me is one of the great reasons that people reject the gospel today, the salvation that God has provided in His Son, Jesus Christ, the salvation that is pleasing to Him. The issue is, what is the salvation that pleases God? That's all that matters. It does not matter one bit whether I understand it. And we grow in our understanding of the majesty of the salvation that God has provided in His Son as we grow as Christians. But to become a Christian, or to even live as a Christian, I don't know the fullness of why God has saved man the way that He has saved man. The only thing that matters is this is what pleases God. And if Naaman was smart enough to be God, he'd have healed himself by now. But the fact that he's not healed indicates that he's entering into a realm he knows nothing about. But the Naaman, and if you're a Naaman tonight, you know how bug you get about that. I mean, we know everything about everything, don't we? And the issue isn't this river or that river. I can dunk myself in this one or dunk myself in this one, or this one's cleaner, or this is a cleaner salvation. And for a Naaman, a salvation, you know, designed and made by Naamans for Naamans, they love that. I'll be cleansed by doing this and doing that and all of that. They love that kind of a religion. They love that kind of a religious system. The problem is there's no cleansing of leprosy or sin in those systems. All that God is wanting out of Naaman is for him to accept what he has said and then obey him. And if he will obey him, he will end up cleansed. And that's all that God is desiring of the Naamans that we are. We could be tonight. You're a rejecter of the Lord. You're confronted with your sin. You can't change that. I mean, you got a reputation that is bigger than life all throughout the community. But you know that there's something about your life that you can't control, and it's a sin, and it dominates your life. And then you come into contact with some Christian preacher, and he calls you a sinner, and you've never been called a sinner in your entire adult life. Call me a sinner in that stupid blue building on a corner of 10th and F with the windows painted. Who does he think he is? Doesn't he know what I make a year? Doesn't he know my position? Doesn't he know my title? I don't need to know those things. The issue is that is your condition. And the issue is not what salvation you would devise. The issue is what is the salvation that pleases God. And this is the way that pleased God. Go to the Jordan River, dunk yourself in the river 7 times, and you will be cleansed. Another reason that Naaman doesn't like it is what his servants bring out in verse 13. And his servants came and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, you'd have loved that, wouldn't you? Listen, save a corporation from bankruptcy and you'll be saved. A line would form. And, you know, crawl on your hands and knees, you know, from here to the center plaza, you know, in broken glass every inch of the way, and then you'll be saved. Hey, a line would form outside this door. The kookier the thing of a salvation that a person will devise, nutty stuff. I mean, stuff, comic book stuff. Remember when I would read comics, when I was a kid in the comics, you could send away for, you know, your theological degree on the back of those. And then when I moved, no, seriously, they had that thing, you know, you could do that. And then come to find out when I moved here that the guy lived here in Modesto that did that whole scam. But it was right there. It was right there with the sea monkeys on the back page of the comics. You get your diploma, you get tax exempt status for your house, and you get some sea monkeys all at the same time. If the nuttier it is, the kookier it is, people will get in line to do it as long as it has the characteristic of me doing something to earn it so that somehow it's based on my righteousness. But they recognize, listen, if he had asked you to do something great, you would have done it. How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So he went down and he dipped 7 times in the Jordan according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Just simple obedience. And he was cleansed of his leprosy, and his skin became like the flesh of a little child. Interesting, is it like being born again, isn't it? Brand new skin. Brand new baby's skin. That's all that God wanted, was his simple obedience. And here is this man, this self-made man, and we look at his life and we realize how close he came to needlessly remaining uncleansed. How many people remain uncleansed because they look at the gospel and they say, it doesn't involve me doing something to earn my salvation. It involves me receiving a free gift from God. They want to do something. It's already been done. So many sinners move away from the gospel for that reason. But here he is. He just obeys. And that's all that God wanted out of him. And then he returned to the man of God, he and all of his aides, and he came and stood before him. And he said, indeed, now I know that there is no God in all of the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. And Elisha said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing. And he urged him to take it, but Elisha refuses it. Here is a new believer that's got $2.5 million on him. And he's willing to give it to you right now. And Elisha says no. It tells you a little bit about his character. A little bit about his character. And Elisha says no because he knows the kind of a man he's dealing with. Self-made man. God helps those who help themselves kind of person. And he doesn't want to confuse in the mind of Naaman at all. He does not want Naaman to leave at all with the idea that somehow he bought something from God. That God gave him something because he knew that, God knew that he was going to give him $2.5 million. Elisha doesn't want money to confuse the issue at all, and he turns all of it down. He says, I'm going to receive nothing. And the guy tries to force the money on him, and he refuses it. And so Naaman said, then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will no longer offer either burnt offerings or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. Yet in this thing may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon. When I bow down in that temple, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing. And then Elisha said to him, go in peace. And he departed from him a short distance. And so, to me, as you look at that, you know, you say, well, why would he say, you know, go in peace? You can, he'd probably say, you know, either go in peace as it relates to the journey home, and it's not a condoning of this temple thing, or just like, go in peace. This will be taken care of between you and God before you even get back to your master. And the Lord has a wonderful way of clearing things out of our lives. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "Look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian while not receiving from his hands what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." The only thing this man has learned from his master is spiritual language. His heart is nothing like his master. But he's got a little bit of the God talk all figured out in this. And so Gehazi pursued Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. And he said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me." "No, he hasn't. That's a lie." Saying, "Indeed, just now two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments." And so Naaman said, "Please take two talents." And he urged him, and he bound two talents of silver in two bags and with two changes of garments. And he handed them to two of his servants, and they carried them on ahead of him. And then when he came to the citadel, Gehazi, he took them from their hand, stored them away in the house, and then he let the men go, and they departed. It's interesting as it relates to Gehazi, because God is, I think, working in his life the way he works in all of our lives, and that is he's trying to deal as privately as possible with a secret sin. But if it can't be dealt with in private, God is going to bring it out into the open, and he brings it out into the open here. And here is Gehazi. He is using a work of God to bring material gain to himself. And that is a great temptation in ministry. When God works and does something, to then use that as an opportunity to bring gain to myself. One of the reasons that it's so tragic is that Gehazi, as the servant of Elisha, was, as was the case with the servant of the prophet, next in line to become the prophet. What he threw away for two changes of clothes and two talents of silver was unbelievable. The power of covetousness, that ungodly desire for more, what he throws away. And the interesting thing is that by the time this thing gets done, he's going to have what he wanted, but God isn't going to allow him to enjoy it. He's not going to have the capacity to enjoy it. But you notice his method. The first thing about him is he knows where the money is. He knows who to target. Remember when we first came to Modesto, I was flipping through the stations and they had a religious station on, one of the religious stations in town. There was a local ministry that was on, and I was watching this guy, and he was really working the aisles. I mean, he's a sweat guy. I mean, he'd really work up and down and everything and all, and he was just going on and on about money. And then, he declared on the television, "There, I'm just minding my own business, critiquing Christian television." And so I'm watching, I'm sitting just watching television, watching the competition. And hey, when you're starting, you're a little goofed up on some stuff, all right? So I'm watching this thing, and this guy begins to declare the fact that God had raised up his ministry, and his ministry was to the rich. Somebody has to reach the rich in this community, and so he's going on and on and on. Well, anyway, that ministry doesn't exist today, and it didn't exist very much long after that show. But a Gehazi knows where the money is. He targets the money. That's the way that he operates, and he's never afraid to use a little spiritual talk, as the Lord lives. And his story is very, very carefully crafted. It's a lie that is designed to touch the hardest of hearts. Two prophets came out of the hills, and they didn't have enough clothing. We didn't have a change of clothes for them, and they didn't have the tuition for the school, and we need two talents of silver for them. And here is Elisha, and he's unable to provide for the needs of the people in the school. He's unable to care for them. My master is broke, and he needs you, Naaman, like he's never needed you before. And the program's going to die unless you come through right now. You've got to do something for us right now. And my master sent me. Let's go ahead and take the offering right now. If we can just go ahead and... The interesting thing with the Gehazi, I mean, this is a portrait of so much. The interesting thing with the Gehazi is there's always an urgency. He never leaves you time to pray. Never leaves you time to seek the Lord. It's always got to be done right now. You've got to do it right now. You've got to write that out right now. You've got to give it to right now. And notice with the Gehazi that he's very, very good at putting all of the pressure on you. And if you don't do something, then God's servants are going to starve and they're going to go without clothing and the ministry's going to collapse. I'll tell you, I just look at those kinds of scenes and I just say, well, go ahead and let it. Remember one time I was at a Christmas program at a religious gathering here in the community. They brought all of the teachers at school and they brought them up in front of all of us who had our kids in that school. And as they brought all of the teachers up, they began to tell us what a wonderful job the teachers had done. It was Christmas time thus far in the year. I had them all standing there and I just looked at them and, you know, godly men and women who are serving the Lord at enormous sacrifice to educate Christian children in the community. And as they're all standing there, all these things are being laid out, and then we're told that they're not going to have a Christmas bonus unless we provide the offering that night. And all we're all just looking at one another here, and you know, and it was a Gehazi. The whole thing was thrown on us, and they were used as a tool in the thing. And I just put my wallet away. I would have been glad to give something. Would have been glad to do it, but I'm not going to reinforce manipulation or that kind of methodology. I felt so terrible for the teacher. And so Gehazi's, that's the way that they operate. And the interesting thing about Gehazi's, and the reason there is no shortage of Gehazi's, is that it works. It works. And that's why they use these methods. And you take, and they always justify their use of these methods by those works, those words. But it works. Is it deceitful? Yes, but it works. Is it manipulation? Yes, but it works. Is it, you know, is it the use of guilt? Yes, but it works. That's all that ever matters to a Gehazi, is that it works. We got the money out of them. No concern for the glory of God. No concern for the new believer. No concern that people are going to call him to wrong conclusions about God, His ability to provide for His servants, His ability to provide for His work, and that what He is doing to this man and what He's planning in terms of misconceptions concerning God in just one life is worse than $2.5 million. So what if it raises $2.5 million if God is not properly represented? And so Gehazi, he sells all of this, all of his reputation, all of his future, all of these things for 2 lousy talents of silver and 2 changes of clothes. The interesting thing is he gains it, but he's not going to enjoy it. And that is so often the way as it relates to these things. And notice in verse 24 that none of it went to the people he said it was going to go to. It went right into his room. And so he went in and he stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, "Where'd you go, Gehazi?" And he said, "Your servant didn't go anywhere." And then Elisha said to him, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? Is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Gehazi, is that what we represent as being supreme? Vineyards and goats and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? Is this really the need of the hour when judgment hangs over an entire nation and over an entire land that you would sell yourself out for 2 talents of silver and 2 changes of clothes? Is that the big need of this day and this hour? Of course it wasn't. He said, "Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever." And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. And there's no argument from Gehazi at all. There's no protest, because there was nothing to protest. I tell you, and I exhort myself, the danger of misrepresenting God. And you can get yourself in positions where there can be enormous temptation to do that. And all of a sudden, you know, instead of the need of the hour in Modesto, California, and in Ceres, and in Turlock, and in Ripon, and in Salida, and in the United States of America, we can turn around, and for us as Christians, what we're representing as the great need of the hour is not a spiritual awakening or, you know, the continued going forth of the gospel into the world or repentance in the light of such depravity and such darkness. When they see us give, you know, fall down to the same level of seeking the same things as they do, and it does such great harm to the cause of the Lord in this day and in this hour in which God has called us. Let's be careful of covetousness. For 30 pieces of silver, Judas sold the King of Glory away. That's how powerful that sin is. Well, we'll stop there tonight.